This is Jim Eakster. Coming today on the show, we will visit with Leonard Moldenau. His book is Subliminal, How Your Unconscious Mind Rules Your Behavior. Fascinating man, Leonard Moldenau, a physicist, author, and screenwriter. Also, Jeffrey Sado, professor of political science at LSU Shreveport. He is Governor Jindal's favorite college professor. Jeffrey Sado writes prolifically about politics in Louisiana and is an ardent defender of Governor Jindal and his policies. We will talk with him about why he is supportive of the governor. Jeffrey Sado, professor of political science at LSU Shreveport and a staunch Republican as well. All this, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Eakster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher is producing, and we begin our show with Dr. Jeffrey Sado. He is an associate professor of political science at LSU Shreveport. He's been there for 12 years, has degrees from the University of Oklahoma, Vanderbilt, and the University of New Orleans. He is a person who follows Louisiana politics and blogs about it frequently. And he is here to talk about the state of affairs with Governor Bobby Jindal. Good morning, Dr. Sado.
Howdy.
I have said that you may be Governor Jindal's favorite college professor. Would you argue with that description?
I guess the favorite known one. There may be others out there, but I guess I put out there in public, if the public wants to look around and look for it and find it, I'll put it out there publicly at least.
Okay. He has stated that he reads you, he likes your work, and you have been critical on occasion, but more often than not, you have been supportive of his initiatives.
Obviously Governor Jindal is a very perceptive man by making those comments.
297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757 for Dr. Jeffrey Sado. You are a Republican, Dr. Sado, is that correct?
If you go and check cattle or those repairs registration, I think I wouldn't deny that.
Well, there's nothing wrong with being a member of the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, but I would imagine that you've been supportive of the governor throughout his political career. You've been at LSU Shreveport since he was elected to Congress and ran for governor the first time, the second time, and the third time. What is it about him that that attracted you from the start?
Well, we share largely the same political philosophy on the issues of the day. In Louisiana, there are basically two different kinds of conservative wings to the state's political discourse. One comes more purely out of the populist tradition of the state. The other is more more principled in a way, and that's the wing that I've always identified myself with. And I think looking at Governor Jindal's actions and usually his rhetoric, I think that it's fair to say that he's part of that as well. So we have he and I agree on a number of things, and that's why I've been largely supportive of the things he's done and tried to do. Again, usually, not always, but usually.
Dr. Sado, have you talked to him individually in the last several months, years? Does that happen?
I've had one conversation with him 5 years ago. It was for about 5 minutes when he was visiting LSUS on his campaign prior to his first successful election, and that's it. That's all I've, as a matter of fact, I've spent more time talking to Governor Blanco than I have Governor Jindal.
Now, your writings come with your blog. They come with a disclaimer that people who take offense shouldn't complain to your bosses at LSUS. The work represents your views, and you're entitled, as the First Amendment allows all of us, you're entitled to have views. And do people get hot and bothered sometimes by what you write?
Yes, I've there have been elected state officials, previously elected state officials, others appointed in state government who have called my superiors at various levels and voiced you know, a slight amount of dissatisfaction maybe with some of the things that, that have appeared, but I've been blessed to have superiors both now and previously that I'd have always supported generally my my ability to be able to express that opinion as well as for other faculty members. So that's never been a problem where I work.
And my guess, as an associate professor, you also have tenure.
Yes, indeed I do. And had I not, I would have. That would be an entirely reckless. It would be entirely reckless of me to be so openly purveying these the views that I purvey if I didn't have tenure.
Why do you think Louisiana, Dr. Sato, has veered rightward and is a solidly red state now? Why has that happened over the last 20 years?
Well, it there's always been that there, at least on social issues. Louisiana, unlike most states in the South, has had a very healthy populist tradition. I mean, even if you look at a little over 100 years ago, the only real competition to the Democratic Party at that point was, in fact, a version of, the, of a populist political party. And prior to Republicans finally breaking through beginning in the 1970s back into the legislature, the only non-Democrats that it served were representatives of populist political parties. So that's always introduced an element of economic liberalism into the state's politics, which you did not see as much of in the South, although it's a common misperception that that the South always has been economically conservative. It wasn't, in fact. In the 1930s, it was among the biggest supporters of the economic provisions of the New Deal. But on the conservative side, social issues, the state always has been, and it's taken, in essence, a while for the South in general, but Louisiana in particular, to catch up on the economic side of conservatism. So really, it's just been a trend that has been building since really the 1960s. There's added to this conservative social dimension. We now find, there's been a realization of community of interest between conservatism and the Republican Party as it represented conservatism. And the thinking of a majority in Louisiana, this was largely started around the Goldwater period, but really I think was accelerated by the presidency of Ronald Reagan, because he was able to, called the great communicator, he was able to put into terms that people that ordinarily don't think explicitly ideologically or discuss politics and ideological terms, he was able to put those kinds of thoughts and sentiments into language and discourse that the public would understand. You know, not just in Louisiana, but in the country as a whole. And so I think that sped up this transformation, so to speak. And it's just when a critical mass was reached in the 1980s, and you began to get politicians in Louisiana who began to explicitly identify themselves as Republicans, and as part of that agenda, I think it began to snowball from there.
297-5633 if you'd like to join the conversation with Dr. Jeffrey Sato. He is an associate professor in political science at LSU Shreveport. He's been there for a dozen years, and he is a supporter on most issues with Governor Bobby Jindal. Now, today, the headlines across the state indicate, as they should, that the Louisiana Association of Business and Industry has come forward with an opinion about the governor's tax swap, and LABI is solidly against this. Does that surprise you?
No, it really would not have surprised me for that to go either way. I think the business community, at some level, agrees with the idea of especially getting rid of corporate income taxation, but income taxation in general, because it would tend to stimulate demand as well as, of course, take away that expense from their own operation. But, of course, business, and in particular because the plan expands the proportion of businesses that would have to charge sales tax. You know, again, business occurs because people are consuming and making sales, and anything that dampens that is something that would concern business. So, you know, this was really something I think that could have gone either way, and it wouldn't have surprised me for them to go either direction. But of course, the larger issue here is that there was even this chance that there would not be agreement by this group with this particular administration, and that's certainly a major departure. There are few issues to date where lobby has not agreed with Governor Jindal, and so that in and of itself is significant. But at the same time, we have to understand that part of the conservative tradition here in Louisiana has been backed by business, but there's always been somewhat of an element of cronyism in there, in the sense that business has been supportive of what we generally identify as conservative principles, not so much because of the principles themselves, but because it can be used as a tool to be able to enhance business interests through cronyistic practices like the motion picture investor tax credit and other forms. I just mentioned that because that's the most notorious in terms of the actual transfer of wealth that occurs as a result of it. So the support has not always been entirely principled in that sense, and here we can see this distinction really coming out, because I think for the most part conservatives are very interested in the idea of reducing income taxation, even if it means an increase in a tax on consumption, sales tax. And now, clearly here we're seeing the divergence of interests between traditional business interests and what the governor's, the ideas in which the governor has based his proposal.
All right. Are you enthused about the governor's plan? What's your assessment?
Well, I'm generally supportive of it. I do have a couple of concerns. One is that it tends to ignore or downplay the compliance and regulatory costs that will come about. I mean, for example, the plan is basically saying, "All right, you don't have to deal with the income tax paperwork anymore." So you can get rid of all that, and that's certainly a savings in the minds of people. But then, for many others, you're introducing an entirely different set of paperwork, if not for the for business owners themselves who are finding themselves newly taxed, existing business owners who now have to pay a differential rate and figure out where the differential rate has to be paid on things that they weren't paying it on before, as well as the beneficiaries of the rebates, supposedly. So, again, Social Security recipients, state retiree, pension recipients, military retirees, and active duty, you know, those making below $15,000 a year, according to the plan, as it is as of today, it changes almost every day. But as of today, it basically is saying they're going to have to fill out some kind of new paperwork, or at least some segment of them will. And so I'm not sure how well that's going to go over with people.
Before it becomes law, of course, it has to be approved by lawmakers.
Right.
And it needs two-thirds support in the House and the Senate. And with all of these coalitions coming out against the plan, how can the governor get 70 votes in the House and 26 votes in the Senate?
Well, I think he's got to keep preaching about how it's going to, at least the way it's designed now, it's going to reduce taxes overall in general for basically any income group. Now, I'm sure that individual situations are going to vary, and some people would, in fact, would be paying more under this. But at the same time, generally speaking, typically, people are going to pay less. So he needs to emphasize that. And so even if your sales taxes are going to go up, the argument is, well, you save on income taxes and you'll save more on those than you would on any additional sales tax. But, you know, again, it admittedly, this is being transferred to business. And
all right, hold that thought, and we'll return in 90 seconds with Dr. Jeffrey Saddo. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 877-217-5757 is the number for you wherever you may be. And you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We'll spend a bit more time with Dr. Jeffrey Satto, LSU political scientist. He's based on the campus in Shreveport and is known for his internet blogging and his support, which often comes for Governor Bobby Jindal, occasional criticism. Allison asks about the governor's refusal to accept the Medicaid expansion. Is this a prudent decision by Governor Jindal? Dr. Satto?
Well, I think so. As a matter of fact, that's going to be today's blog post. I'm going to be talking a little bit about that. Couple days ago, the Department of Health and Hospitals came out with a revised study, essentially, on that very issue, and it said basically at a minimum the state over the next 10 years could save about $20 million, given the parameters that it analyzed this information with. But the point that has been made by Jindal and other opponents is that there are a large number of risk factors out there which are difficult to properly quantify and put into an analysis. So, for example, just some of these is the assumption that that Medicaid and Medicare provision will still be out there with primary care physicians, and that's probably not likely. The CBO and others continue to revise their estimates on that in terms of costs, and there's also this assumption that there's going to be that provider rates will be maintained. Without going into a lot of details, that's a fairly questionable assumption, which means that one of the areas the state was thinking about cost savings in was in uncompensated care, but that's probably not as likely to happen as this and some other reports are making them out to be. And so that alone would be something that might tip it against this current cost estimate. You know, it's very ironic because actually one of the main factors as to why the state says, or DHH here says, that there could be a savings is because of the implementation of the Bayou Health Medicaid plan, which is basically a premium support plan. It probably ended up with the projected increase in enrollment, it would probably have saved $85 million over what had the old system been maintained, and that alone is, so obviously $65 million more than the $20 million per year in savings over the next decade that was estimated. So, that's just one example. There are others out there, such as what's called the woodwork effect. People coming out of that are not insured and going to be insured, and there's some other. You'd have to read the whole post to get all that, but basically, I'm in agreement here in that there are so many risk factors out there that aren't properly being evaluated that it would be quite a risk to go out there and believe that the state would save money over the long haul by that expansion.
Well, the Department of Health this week issued a report showing the state could save as much as $367 million over the course of a decade. You may not agree with those numbers, but many do, and many say they could save even more. Is there any way the governor changes his mind on this, or do you think he has drawn the proverbial line in the sand?
No, I think there's maybe a little wiggle room there coming from the decision that CMMS made about Arkansas and how they were wanting to alter the way in which they delivered the program, which is somewhat closer to the Bayou Health concept that Louisiana's been engaged in. So, maybe if something like that came down the road, that might be something that would change in mind. So I wouldn't say it's inflexible, but I'd say odds are he's not going to change his mind on it.
Dr. Jeffrey Satto, next week, Bernie Pinsonat, one of the well-known pollsters in Louisiana, he will present a poll that he's been conducting over the last few weeks regarding the governor's popularity and others in the state. Most of us are anticipating the governor's numbers will be down some. Will this in any way influence how lawmakers receive the governor if the poll numbers are not favorable to the leader of the state?
Sure. It depends upon if there's a drop, the magnitude of that drop. If it's down, say he's running around 50% right now, let's say it goes down to 45, that's probably not going to do a whole lot to encourage dissent. But, goes much below that, then maybe that's something that would embolden enough legislators. Again, a number of the things that are going on now are projected to go on. So, for example, let's say some of the education measures that are in front of the state Supreme Court are struck down, requiring a two-thirds vote in one instance in order to be able to enact it, or a majority in another instance. There could be erosion of support on those things to, in essence, reenact those things if that's what the court does in that kind of environment. So, I guess we'll see what happens. But if there's a noticeable drop, then it could make life a little more difficult for him.
You're saying below 45% is the danger zone for the governor?
Yeah, I suspect as such. That's kind of back of the envelope calculations there. But it's generally difficult for any executive with that kind of polling numbers to be able to advance bold things. It's Jindal in his first term wasn't tremendously bold in a number of ways, at least in ways that the legislature had to deal with. I was speaking of Bayou Health a little earlier. That's actually a very significant change in policy, but it was one that didn't have to go through the legislature. But the things that had to, so for example, education reform and now tax reform, those things do require, in many instances, super majorities to do certain things. And so, it becomes an increasingly important thing. If again, given the boldness of these kinds of things, now if Jindal's agenda was less ambitious and aggressive, then those kinds of popularity considerations may not matter that much. Especially since the governor has a number of informal tools that he can try to use to gain support. So influencing, for example, committee selections and leadership in the legislature, line item vetoes on capital projects and the like. So he can use those kinds of tools, and even in a lower popularity environment, they may be enough. But when he's going after very bold reforms like this tax reform, then you do need maybe not huge majorities to do these things, but you need sufficient ones. And I don't think when you're getting down in the lower 40s that legislators are going to be as impressed with that, and it'll make it harder to get those kinds of majorities.
Well, my guess is that his poll numbers may be below 45%, but we shall see. Mm-hmm. In fact, Bernie Pinsonet will be with us next Wednesday. Robert Burns writes, should Governor Jindal present this tax swap as a constitutional amendment, even though he says he is not doing this? What do you think of this, Dr. Sato?
That's the proposal that Treasurer Kennedy had floated. Making an amendment is add one step to the process. You still need the two-thirds majority in the legislature to be able to proceed with that. And, of course, the people would have a direct say in it, unlike if you just make it a part of statute. The only difficulty I would have with that is I'm not a big fan of writing specific things like that into the Constitution. A couple of years ago we had a constitutional amendment that reformed in certain areas, but had attached to it a 4 cents renewal of a tobacco tax. It's just putting such specific things like that in the Constitution, I just don't think is ever a good idea. You need the Constitution to be a very broad framework of how government operates. and not so much a repository for very specific policy items.
Okay, 297-5633 is your number for Dr. Jeffrey Satto. We'll take a few calls. Please be brief. Sharon in Prairieville. Sharon, good morning. You're on the air with Dr. Satto.
Good morning. I'd like to just make a comment. I understood from early on that the governor was using Texas as an example for his new swamp. But in Texas, they supplement the income tax by a very high property tax.
All right. I don't know if you could hear Sharon, but she says Texas is not a fair example of a state that does not have an income tax, because they have higher property taxes than we do in Louisiana.
Yeah, that's correct. They're not abnormally high. They're about, I think, 21st, something like that, but they certainly are much higher than Louisiana's, which is about 48th, 49th, something like that, in terms of the actual take. So there is a greater mix there in terms of property and sales being the two elements that drive it, and they would be more evenly driving it than this proposal, which would be heavy, very heavy on sales taxes, and obviously no property or income tax going into state coffers. Now, in many states, property taxes can be levied by the state. And actually, this is true in Louisiana as well. What's not very well known is that the state may levy its own property tax. So right now in Louisiana, only local jurisdictions are able to do that. But the Constitution does allow for a state property tax. So the state could go that route as part of this. But it's limited to 5.75 mils, so it would raise only, if you consider this a small amount, only about $180 million. So it clearly wouldn't come near to offsetting the estimated $2 billion plus that would be, quote, lost by elimination of the income tax.
Now, the governor spent 86 days that we know of last year out of state, many of that on campaign junkets. It's obvious that he, at some point, perhaps as early as 2016, would like to run for president of the United States. Do you find any fault with that endeavor?
Well, it's an interesting case of deja vu. If we think back 15 or so years when Mike Foster was in the governor's mansion, and people were all carping about him not going anywhere, not ever leaving the state to go see anything. And Foster's reply in those days was, what do I have to do? Go running around to sell the state or whatever. I can just do that just as easily here and so on. And certainly there is some benefit to Louisiana by having the governor out and about and visible. It seems though, but we don't have this happy medium between the two. And, we are in a more modern communication era. There wasn't cell phones, instant messaging capability in those days, and the internet and email, it was only in its infancy then. So I can, when the governor makes arguments about, well, I can conduct state business on the road, there's a fair amount of truth to that. At the same time, though, I think the public perception is that you have a governor who's less engaged by traveling so much. Even if he can sit there and say, well, I do plenty of work via these other instruments, it's just something I don't think that is going to sink into the consciousness of the public. So he's going to draw criticism for that, it may be something that he wants to revisit in terms of the political perception that it puts out there, and how that perception might affect his policymaking ability. I don't know if it's a performance problem, but it's certainly a perception or image problem for him.
All right, 297-5633 in our remaining time with Dr. Jeffrey Satto of LSU Shreveport. I mentioned that you came to LSU in 1991. That's 22 years ago.
Yeah, what you're thinking of is I was out for a year. I was on sabbatical. I was teaching at the university. But, yeah, I've actually been there since 1991.
1991, that was the year that Edwin Edwards beat David Duke in a runoff for governor. That was an interesting time in our state's history.
Oh, yeah, it's very, very interesting that, you know, 3 months after I come back to the state, of course, I was educated here at the University of New Orleans, but come back to the state and get all into the middle of that. Those were, in fact, very, very interesting times, and for a while it was helpful for my academic career because I had plenty to be able to do research on that election in particular.
Well, that election was one that probably shaped the politics in this state for some time. David Duke, of course, was an extremist and was defeated handily by Edwin Edwards, 61-39%. But Duke did get a majority of the white votes. Do you think that in any way affected future elections?
Well, there was an interesting academic argument after that about, you know, in a sense, whether that to some degree poisoned the well, the future for someone like Bobby Jindal. There was, after the 2003 contest, there was a theory that was put out there that essentially Jindal lost because there weren't enough whites in North Louisiana in particular voting for him. And in fact, I joined that particular discussion with some published pieces in some academic journals. And there was a small bit of truth to that. There seemed to be a bit of a drop-off, and probably not so much because Jindal is non-white, but because he's so identifiably not Louisiana in a sense. I mean, yes, he was born in Louisiana. He's native through and through, except for the time he spent in undergraduate and graduate school. And he came back, although he, of course, went to Washington for a little while in there. But, yeah, I mean, obviously he's from native-born Louisiana and all that.
We're short on time, but do you think he has any shot of being the president of the United States anytime soon?
I think he's got a small shot at it. There's a lot of competition out there, and there's a strong bench for the Republicans in 2016 and beyond. So he's got a lot of competition out there, but I certainly wouldn't rule it out.
How does the difficulties having on the home front, how does that affect his ambition?
Well, if he gets into a position where he's really becomes a top-tier favorite, you know, that's obviously going to be something that's used against him by Republican or other opponents. The populist right in Louisiana doesn't like him because he's not a populist. And so it's something that's going to detract a little bit from his performance. But there's such a nationally, he seems to have such a good reputation that at this point I don't think it's going to matter much.
Well, thank you, Dr. Sato. Good to visit with you, and let's talk again.
Sure, why not?
Take care. All right. Thank you, sir. We'll return with Leonard Mlodinow. His book is Subliminal, How Your Unconscious Mind Rules Your Behavior. Back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to WRKF 89.3 in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. 877-217-5757. We're joined now by Leonard Mlodinow. The Huffington Post says he's a man at home with big ideas, really big ideas. A physicist, an author, professor, Mlodinow has spent much of the last few decades exploring life's most complicated questions. What's the nature of the universe? How does the human mind work? Did Darwin go wrong? What's the role of randomness in our lives? And is there a grand design in the universe? And his latest work is Subliminal, How Your Unconscious Mind Rules Your Behavior. Good morning, Leonard Mlodinow.
Good morning.
It is a big topic, one that I'm sure that is fascinating to many. And we often wonder how our subconscious mind affects our lives, and other people's subconscious minds affect their lives and ours by extension. What's the basic message from Subliminal?
Well, the basic message is that in the last 20 years, scientists have discovered that the unconscious mind is nothing like the traditional concept of it that Freud and Jung and others had promoted. And that 95% of the thought processes that go on in your brain go on in structures or parts of your brain that are inherently not accessible to your conscious awareness. And that this affects not only your perception, your visual perception or your physical perception, but your perception of people, your perception of businesses, of financial decisions. And so that while you're making what you think are conscious decisions based on thoughts that you're aware of and factors that you're weighing in your mind, those decisions and those perceptions are also based to a great extent on things that are going on in the background in your mind that you're not aware of thinking about.
Well, what experiences in your own past motivated your interest in this subject?
Well, I had written a book called The Drunkard's Walk about how randomness rules your life. And that was about how the world around you, how people misperceive the world around them if they don't understand the role of luck and chance. And toward the end of that book, I started to explore why that happens. And I discovered that that comes from unconscious processes that go on in your brain. And that just kind of exploded. The more I read about that for that book, the more I realized that, wow, our perceptions and our judgments and all aspects of social life, not just randomness, are affected by the unconscious. And so I saw this book as a kind of a companion to that book, because this book tells you how you misperceive your inner world, your own feelings, your own perceptions, if you don't understand your unconscious mind. Where the other book talks about how you misperceive the world around you, the outside world.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your life, as I noted, you're a physicist and an author, but at one point in your life, Leonard, you left the academic world for Hollywood and worked for a screenwriter for 10 years. What prompted that? Was it something going on in your unconscious mind?
I'm sure it was. I've always loved to write. I guess since I was a kid, I had two passions. One was math and science, and the other was writing. I started writing short stories in third grade. And so when I got my first job at the California Institute of Technology, which is in Pasadena, right next to Los Angeles, I thought, well, I'd switch from writing short stories in my spare time to writing screenplays. And eventually I got work, and I worked for MacGyver and Star Trek The Next Generation and many shows for a number of years. It was fun, but I'm glad to be back to doing science and a more serious kind of writing now.
Leonard Mlodinow is our guest. His book is Subliminal, How Your Unconscious Mind Rules Your Behavior. Now, according to Subliminal, our preference in politicians, the amount we tip our waiters, all judgments, all perceptions reflect the workings of our mind on two levels, the conscious, of which we are aware, and the unconscious, which is hidden from us. How do we get in touch with our unconscious?
Well, the reason I wrote Subliminal was just to do that. You can't really bring your unconscious to consciousness, so to speak, but you can learn through the work of all the scientists what sorts of influences your unconscious is providing, and therefore use your conscious mind to take that into account or to oppose them if you wish. I mean, our unconscious mind is a gift to us. It's not something that tricks us. It's something that all animals have and that we've developed to help us live, to help us navigate our environment, and to help us, you know, smoothly interact with each other. But it can sometimes lead us astray, just as it does, let's say, in vision. You have optical illusions. This is a case where your unconscious mind is tricking your conscious mind into seeing something that's not really there. And the same sort of thing happens in social situations. For instance, we were just talking about Bobby Jindal and politics.
Right.
Well, when you judge people, you're not just judging people based on the facts you learn about their character, their behavior, or their views, or what they tell you. You're also judging them about more subtle things, such as how their smile affects you, how the way they hold their body language, the sound of their voice, the cadence with which they speak. All these things, as social animals, have an effect on us. And, of course, sometimes we realize an effect. We go, ooh, that person is beautiful, or that person is unattractive looking. But I'm talking about much more subtle effects that you're not aware are happening. And you're picking up these signals from your environment all the time. For example, a professor at Princeton a few years ago gathered pairs of headshots of all the Democratic and Republican candidates from dozens of races around the country, gubernatorial races, congressional races, And he brought subjects into the lab to view these pairs of photos very briefly and just pick which candidate looked more competent. And if they recognized a candidate, then he didn't count that pair. And he gathered all this data together and got a general judgment of the public about which candidate in each race looks more competent, not more beautiful, but more competent. And then he predicted the outcome of the 2006 races based purely on who looked more competent. And now, of course, many people will vote either Democrat or Republican all the time, but as we know, the votes are really determined by swing voters. And these swing voters think that they're taking into account
right.
a lot of factors, probably not looks, but what he found was he was correct in 70% of the elections. 70% of the elections, the more confident person or the more confident looking person won the election. So obviously this effect of someone's face has a great effect on the way we judge them, even though if you ask voters, they would probably deny that they were voting based on who looked better.
Huh. You note in the book that we often make judgments about people by their names.
That's right, because one other thing one other effect of the unconscious is to give us a certain optimism about the future, a certain optimism about our own lives. And so we tend to be attracted to things that remind us of ourselves. And so scientists did an interesting study where they took some of the most common names, Smith, Jones, Cooper, and they went through marriage records to see who married whom. And they found now that if the name didn't have an influence on us, and these were all names of the same white Anglo-Saxon ethnicity in general, that in other words, they weren't ethnic names like an Irish name or an Italian name. They were just ordinary American names, so they couldn't explain an effect by that. You would think that a Smith would marry a Smith and a Jones would marry a Jones. A Smith would marry a Jones as often as another Smith, and so on. But what they found was Smiths tended to marry Smiths, Jones tended to marry Joneses, Coopers tended to marry Coopers, and so forth. Washingtons tended to marry Washingtons more often than any of the other names. And this is because you have a certain affinity for someone when they have a name that's the same as yours.
Hmm. And there's a quote here from Albert Einstein that says, strange as our situation here on Earth, each of us comes for a short visit, not knowing why, yet sometimes seeming to a divine purpose. From the standpoint of daily life, however, there's one thing we do know, that we are here for the sake of others. And this is at the start of a chapter from Leonard's book called The Importance of Being Social. How is this reflective of our unconscious mind?
Well, all primates are very social animals, and the human species, as we evolved, we couldn't have survived without cooperation with each other. So we're not the fastest, we're not the strongest, we're not the most vicious animals out there. When we lived in the wild, in order to hunt, to get our food, in order to protect ourselves from the environment and from other animals, we had to cooperate. And so a fundamental part of our nature as a species is to be social. And because of this, we have amazing capabilities that you're probably not even aware of. For instance, you have a special part of your brain that's devoted to identifying other human beings by their face. If you look at a bunch of monkeys or dogs or cats or buildings, of course you can tell some of them apart, but not nearly as well as you can tell people apart because of this part of your brain that's specialized for faces. And I have an interesting example in the book where I have a photo of Barack Obama and another photo of Barack Obama that's been changed in a certain way. And when these photos are right side up, the one that was altered looks horribly deformed. And then you turn the book over and you look at the faces upside down and you can hardly tell which is, they both look totally normal. That's because this part of your brain that identifies faces really was built to identify right side up faces. It doesn't work when the faces are upside down. And so when they're upside down, even though that one looks very deformed, you can hardly tell the difference. But when you turn the book right side up, it's very obvious. Such a dramatic illustration of how our brains were built for our social behavior.
There's a chapter in the book called Self, and you start with a description of what happened with Hurricane Katrina. And you talk about Michael Brown, the head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency at the time, How was the unconscious mind in evidence when Katrina enveloped Louisiana?
Well, Michael Brown, even after the dismal performance of FEMA after the hurricane, was publicly defending himself and saying that he thought he did everything right and nothing wrong. And, of course, he was blaming others. And that's part of a whole discussion I have about how – now we might think, well, that's just self-serving, and he really knows that he didn't do a good job, but he's trying to, for the public record, defend himself. But I have a whole discussion there of people who were clearly did something either evil or something incompetent and defended themselves and in places where clearly you could tell from the context that they truly believed their defense of themselves. For instance, O.J. Simpson, who after he was caught holding up these people at gunpoint to get his paraphernalia back, had a chance to plead for leniency from the judge, but couldn't bring himself to admit that what he did was wrong. And this is because our unconscious mind, in helping us believe in ourselves, gives us a biased view of everything that we do and everything we believe in and everything we feel. And so that was part of that discussion in the book.
You noted that the sub-unconscious mind is quite often at play when we're making judgments about political candidates, when we're not ideologically tied to one or the other. How often do you think that affects elections one way or the other?
Well, I think it had a big effect on elections. For example, as I said, 70% of the candidates who win are the ones who are the most competent looking. It obviously has a huge effect, because if there was no effect from a person's looks, you would expect 50% of the people who win elections to look more to be the ones who look more competent, and 50% to look less competent, because we're ignoring their looks. So the fact that 70% won means that looks are not being ignored, and they're having a great effect on the electorate. In England, Margaret Thatcher realized early in her career that her voice was a little bit too high-pitched and it didn't sound authoritative enough. And she consciously, this is an example of how you can use your conscious mind to help you, she consciously worked on lowering the tone of her voice as she spoke. And that, according to the lore in England, was a great help in her political career, because she sounded much more credible than she had previously.
I guess, though, Leonard, how do political consultants take this information and determine what makes a candidate look more competent?
Well, they do that all the time. There have even been scientific studies of faces, and where they have people come in and judge faces for competence, and then they analyze the features of the faces, and they even have makeup artists and photographers take other pictures of the people to see how they can tweak faces to look more confident. So when you see a political appearance or a political ad or a political photo that the candidate had any influence on at all, you can be sure that they were taking into account the certain principles of making a person look more confident.
Well, let's take somebody.
In the debate, they talked about in the debates, there was a lot of criticism of the way John McCain, for instance, gestured, or what you do with your eyes, where you look. I remember when George Bush looked down at his watch. That was a signal that people consciously noticed that mean that he was bored. I mean, candidates are like actors, and they are quite aware of what they have to do to make you feel that they care and that they're confident and so forth.
What about somebody like, say, Hillary Clinton, who's been on the national and world stage for about a quarter century now? Her appearance is different now than it was when Bill Clinton was the governor of Arkansas running for president. Do people make judgments that stick? Do we still have the same impressions of Hillary Clinton based on what we saw the first time we witnessed her, say, in 1989 or 90?
Well, first impressions are very important, and it's hard to change first impressions, but over time they do change. And of course, most Americans probably outside of Arkansas or the South remember Hillary more as the first lady than as the wife of the governor. And you, as you might notice, that she changes her hair and she changes the way she dresses. And, you know, you can be sure that she does that based on very, very studied political advice. You know, even that a person's hairstyle will affect the way they're perceived. If I remember correctly, the slight widow's peak in a woman has effect in making her look more confident, for instance.
Well, the book is subliminal. The Huffington Post says, with great wit and intelligence, Leonard Mlodinow takes us on a sweeping tour of this mental landscape and the latest revelations in neuroscience. Thank you so much for joining us today, Leonard. And thank you for listening. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.